Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm very excited. I have two guests. We have writers, directors, producers, actors, all of those things, Jocelyn DeBoer and Dawn Luby. Hi.
Hi. We're so happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm Jocelyn.
And I'm Dawn.
Thank you for the distinguishing voice characteristics. I really appreciate that. For those of you guys who aren't as familiar with Jocelyn and Dawn's work, please let me give you an introduction. Jocelyn and Dawn are an award-winning writing and directing team based in Los Angeles, both veteran performers at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Jocelyn and Dawn partnered in 2015 and formed Gulp Splash Productions. I don't know where did that name come from.
It's actually we completely didn't mean to be naming a company when this name came about.
No, it was a real hasty, like, we need to quickly create an LLC to make a short film. Really random name, and then we're stuck with it, I think, and we're not that happy about it.
But the name comes from, so Don's husband is he's a real efficient man.
Yeah.
And he used to eat scrambled eggs for breakfast every day, and he hated how long it took to clean the pan. And then he discovered that he could hard boil eggs. Yeah. He's like, I hard boil a dozen of them at a time. I put them in the fridge, and then in the morning, I just gulp, splash, which means like the egg goes into his mouth, and then
It splashes in the stomach.
Yes. Yeah.
Not a pleasant image at all, but somehow that's our company name now.
Yeah, so Gulp Splash.
That gives you a good idea what their first feature, Greener Grass, is going to be. That premiered at 2019 Sundance Film Festival. They wrote, directed, and co-star in the film alongside Beck Bennett, Neil Casey, Mary Holland, and Darcy Carden, all from lovely shows and, you know, wonderful beloved things, SNL, Ghostbusters, Veep, and The Good Place. Greener Grass is a dark comedy based on their 2016 South by Southwest award-winning short film by the same name. Following its premiere at the Clermont-Ferrand Film Festival in France, the Greener Grass short received a distribution deal with Canal Plus, or should I say Canal Plus?
Plus.
In Europe and Africa. Jocelyn and Dawn recently directed two episodes of True TV's Adam Ruins Everything. In 2017, they sold the television pilot to IFC. They have written and produced three short films, which have appeared in over 70 film festivals worldwide. And you've been to every single film festival, right?
Every single one.
They won Best Direction for their short, The Arrival, at Funicinema Critica de Cine in Argentina. I'm not very good at that.
That's close enough. Good enough.
All right. Okay. The Arrival also was named Best International Short Film at the Roma International Short Film Festival, Best Short Film in the Lounge Comedy Shorts Program at the Napa Valley Film Festival, Best Comedy at the Way Down Film Festival in Georgia, and received the Audience Award at the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Okay. So here's something that you guys didn't include in your bio that I'm real curious about, because neither of you put whether you're from the suburbs.
I am from a suburb of Chicago called Barrington.
And I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, which I don't think it's a suburb of a city. However, I would say it has a very suburban feel.
It's like a suburb of a nation as opposed
to... Yes, there are no big cities nearby.
Are you from a suburb?
I'm not from a suburb, but I understand the suburbs. And I understand the suburbs through a movie that you guys chose to talk about today, which also has bearing on your film, and that is John Waters' Polyester. That's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yay!
So can you tell me a little bit about why you chose that film?
We love Polyester.
I can see that. After watching Greener Grass, I can see this.
Well, here's something that is going to surprise you. Perhaps will surprise you. When we made Greener Grass, we had not seen Polyester. And this blows our minds now that we have seen it. It's a truly, you know, when we're on the film festival circuit, people will come up to us and be like, oh, your movie reminds us so much of this, so much of that. And it was John Waters that we were getting over and over again. And we were both like, well, of course, we've seen Serial Mom, we've seen Hairspray, but like, neither one of us had seen the true, real classic John Waters films. And so it started started, I got deathly ill with a cold when we were in London recently, and I had to skip a film festival and stay home, and I was feeling so sad, and I just did a John Waters marathon, and I watched 6 John Waters movies underneath, like, my sick bed covers. Aww. And Polyester was the first one I watched, and I called Dawn, and I was like, this, I can't believe this exists! Like, you have to watch this, and she did right away.
I watched it the next day on a plane, and then again at home, because I was like, I shouldn't see this good of a movie on an iPad. I need to see it on a TV. And yeah, we both had the exact same reaction, which was sheer delight and disgust and wonder.
I couldn't believe how much I felt known. Like, I couldn't believe, like, Dawn and I, we met performing on a sketch team at Upright Citizens Brigade, and our sketch team really did a lot of these domestic, like, melodramatic sketches, particularly because I think Dawn and I pitched, like, 75% of them. But it's just so what we're interested in. Like, I think I've played characters like Lulu so many times.
Much. Like, Jocelyn always is like the defiant teenager that's like, yeah, a little.
Yeah, and just like always dancing. Anyway, the similarities, we just were shocked. So this is, we can't wait to talk about Polyester.
Yeah, and for those of you who haven't seen Polyester, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Polyester first, I highly recommend. And by the time this episode comes out, there will be a criterion of it. So there you go. And now that you're back, let's introduce Polyester. Written and directed by John Waters, Polyester stars Divine as Francine Fishpaw, an upper-middle-class housewife in a Baltimore suburb. Her husband, Elmer, is a tacky asshole who owns an adult theater in town, which draws a bunch of anti-pornography protesters to their quaint home.
Elmer! Thank God you're home!
Get off of me! Why haven't you notified the press? Think of the publicity! The theater will be packed tomorrow night.
Oh, Elmer, please don't call the press. It's bad enough already. All the neighborhood women spit at me when I'm in the shopping mall.
Then she's got her brat daughter, Lulu, who we were just talking about, and her son, Dexter, who derives pleasure from stomping on women's feet. Okay, and then there's her mother, LaRue, who's always harping on Francine for being fat and for hanging out with their former cleaning lady, Cuddles, who inherited a fat chunk of cash.
Oh, it's Cuddles.
Good Lord, Francine. Don't you know it's bad luck to let retarded people in your home? Call me a cab this instant.
But, Mother, she's my best friend.
Your best friend? She was your cleaning lady, Francine. Are you that unpopular that you seek out the social company of your maid?
But Cuddles is the only one who's actually Team Francine. Francine discovers Elmer's been having an affair with his secretary and confronts them.
Well, I won't stand for this, Elmer. I want a divorce and a big fat settlement to go along with it.
But it only makes her depressed. She drinks a bunch. Lulu proclaims one day that she's getting an abortion, very happy about it.
I'll never allow you to marry him.
Marry him? Are you kidding? I'm getting an abortion and I can't wait.
And Dexter's foot stomping exploits have earned him the media nickname Baltimore Foot Stomper, so he's on the lam. Lulu tries to get an abortion, but an anti-abortion protester prevents her.
Don't have this abortion!
How does it feel to be a murderer?
Babies want to live too, you know!
And she tries to induce a miscarriage, but then Francine calls some Catholic nuns over to drag her off to a home for unwed mothers.
This is Francine Fishpaw, 538 Wyman Way. I need an unwed mother's home. My daughter is pregnant and trying to induce a miscarriage.
We'll be right there!
Lulu's boyfriend, Bobo, comes over with his friends to trash the Fishpaw house in revenge, but LaRue catches them. They shoot her, but LaRue's able to retrieve her gun and shoot Bobo dead. Lulu runs away from the nuns and finds Bobo dead in her room and tries to kill herself. Also, the family dog does successfully hang himself, leaving a suicide note behind. Francine is in the dumps, but a curious thing happens. Dexter leaves prison a reformed man.
I'm sorry for the grief I caused you, but I'm rehabilitated now. I had a wonderful drug counselor in prison, and I received psychiatric treatment.
And Lulu has a miscarriage and rethinks her life's goals, becoming a peaceful flower child.
I've had a miscarriage.
That's awful.
But I've discovered macrame. It's helped me find myself.
I'm gentler now and more creative.
And then Francine meets Todd Tomorrow.
Why don't we take a ride in the country and get away from all this mess? I mean, it's a beautiful day and I find you quite attractive.
But I don't even know your name.
It's Todd, honey.
Todd?
Todd Tomorrow.
All seems so wonderful and perfect, but Francine finds out Todd and LaRue are actually together and are trying to drive Francine crazy so they can take her money.
Not my mother! Help!
Soon, Elmer and his secretary break into the Fishpaw house with the intention of killing Francine and also taking her money. But Dexter and Lulu thwart the attempt and kill both of them. Then, when Todd and LaRue are about to make their attempt, Cuddles pulls up and runs over both of them with her new husband. It's a happy ending for the remaining Fishpaw family.
That's so enjoyable.
Yes. I want you to explain every John Waters movie, yeah. And that was delightful.
It's a lot of stuff happening.
It is.
let's talk about a few bigger ideas. For one, John Waters has I would say, not a warped sense of beauty, but like a very kind of like fine point sense of beauty for him. He said, I first saw Divine and thought raw beauty. To me, beauty is looks you can never forget. I've walked down the street with Divine and seen car accidents happen. And this is something where he really, you know, obviously Divine now deceased, but in this time period when they were working together, thought that Divine was just the most beautiful person alive. And obviously wanted to highlight that.
I feel like I heard a fact that, do you know why I get all the movies confused now? Because I watch them all at once. But it's either Female Trouble or is it where Divine is like
Desperate Women
walking down this, like she's strutting down the street and everybody's like turns their heads and looks at her. That was actual just people on the street and her walking down the street.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what you get when you cast a star in your films. And that's Divine.
Divine is so fantastic in Polyester. I think it's got to be her most beautiful acting performance.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And there's actually a really interesting thing that was happening with this. I think, you know, we should probably put this in context. People who are John Waters fans know about Female Trouble and about Desperate Living and you know, all of these other movies that they had done together, even like the shorts when she was like playing Jackie Onassis in the car. But this was the first time that, you know, Divine was doing any real acting. And so it was a very different role for her. And John Waters was saying, quote, I think it would have been a real mistake for Divine to play the same role again. He'll end up as Charo if he does the same thing over and over. At first, he was nervous because he depended so much on that shock kind of thing. He was so used to that, knew how to do that. But I think once he got into it, he liked it because it was a challenge. I think he's really good. He's gotten good reviews. And many people who have seen the other films have no idea it's a man. When it was over, we told the man who mixed Polyester that it was a man, and he said, I am stunned.
Wow.
So people didn't even know. Like, that was the thing where he, like, transcended gender. He transcended everything to just embody this character. And I thought that was a really lovely performance when I think about it. You know?
Truly. Yeah. And I think the way John Waters directed that performance, and it just shows so much love also for that genre of like those mid-century melodramas. Just, and it, of course you could look at this like, oh, he's making fun of it, this and that, but I think there's so much passion for it.
Yeah.
And you really see that from both Divine, obviously. And
I think we should talk a little bit about shock factor too, because John Waters was talking about that in you know, that last quote that I read. And I mean, having seen his other films, you know, like they're completely shocking, right? So it's just like Pink Flamingos, like eating shit, you know, like whatever, you know, could get butts in the theaters that would make people feel revolted, that would, you know, just get anyone interested in it. And this was obviously a movie where he wanted to add some subtlety to it. He said, quote, I think you can shock people in ways that aren't so obvious. You can be a little more subtle about it. I didn't ask Tab Hunter, for instance, to like do nudity or anything at all that might have embarrassed him. I just wanted to put him in a context that you would never in a million years expect Tab Hunter to be in. I don't think you expect to see a star from that era doing love scenes with Divine. So that's shock value, too, in a sense. I think you can shock people in ways that aren't quite so obvious. You can be a little more subtle about it. He was wanting to do a movie that wouldn't require theater theaters to put sawdust on the ground because people were vomiting.
Yeah. That was, yeah.
One thing he does in Polyester in particular is shock in on many different levels aside from just gross out shock. Mm-hmm. It's nuns taking pregnant teenagers on a hayride in the rain. That is a shocking image and so bizarre, but it's not gross. It doesn't involve bodily fluids. Yeah. Does it? No.
No, I don't think that one does.
But yeah, there's so much surprise from scene to scene that comes from a variety of places.
And I do think that this film, perhaps he does one of his best jobs of having the most eccentric things really connected to the plot and mm-hmm. grounded in the heightened reality of the world. Mm-hmm. And the movie comes off so polished in that way.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some of his others that are so gross and shocking don't. And I feel like that's something that Don and I have the conversation about when we have these extreme things we want to do, is that the most important thing to us is that it's grounded in the reality of our world, and that we're not just doing something that's like weird or bizarre just for weird's sake, mm-hmm. and that it truly has meaning behind it.
Yeah.
One of the first things that happens in our movie is Jocelyn's character Jill gives away her baby to my character, Lisa, as a gesture of politeness, or because Lisa expresses how cute she is. and then, of course, over the course of the movie, comes to regret that decision almost immediately.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even notice. You have a new baby.
Oh yeah, isn't she cute? We wanted to try something new.
She's so cute. I love her.
Lisa, do you want her?
What? No, I couldn't. She's your baby.
Oh, Lisa, you can have her. She's great.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure. Take her. She's yours now.
We didn't want that to just be this weird, random thing because, one, I think we were afraid people would, like, not care about the protagonist mm-hmm. or even the antagonist if that's, you know, how they behave. So it was important to us that was grounded in a bigger theme of the movie that you feel right away of this need to be polite and this awareness the characters have for those around them and fitting in mm-hmm. exactly where they should.
Yeah, it seems like it's important to establish that really in your opening scene. To make sure that people are understanding what that world is.
Yes, that was a conversation we had a lot in the writing of it because it is how we started the short film. And we initially were going to start the feature like that. And then we really were trying to examine it. And we're like, will people just turn away from Jill and not like her if we do this, et cetera. And then we ultimately were like, we have to do it first. Mm-hmm. You just need the audience to know what the movie is right away.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this is
the world we're in.
Yeah, I see. Okay. All right. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, I would say obviously the same thing with John Waters. He's a filmmaker who doesn't waste any fucking time.
Mm-hmm.
He,
mm-hmm.
like, does not care to waste time. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to get a little bit further into his philosophy of film being under 90 minutes. We'll be right back.
This is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, you know, weather.
There was one...
Weather?
One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, the song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy, is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jocelyn DeBoer and Dawn Luby. And we are talking about Polyester. So, editing the film of Polyester, John Waters said, when we put the film together, according to how the original script was written, it was 2 hours. It's now 87 minutes. Everyone agreed on what parts to cut. I cut an hour out of Pink Flamingos, too. No movie should ever be more than 90 minutes. He said that quite a bit. We're just like, his working philosophy when he's in that edit room is like, get this below 90. Because, like, you got to make your point, get in and get out. What do you think of this? How do you guys work?
That I didn't know John Waters said that, but I do love the way Polyester moves.
Yeah.
And I know our movie moves very fast. I think the longest scene is maybe 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, there's, I believe, around 30 locations. And yeah, it just, we wanted to just like bring people in, bring people out, keep it moving. And
we like really would talk about the roller coaster ride when we were riding it. And we were like, we want them to strap in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then like, we just want to have them the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Don and I spent a couple years going to a lot of film festivals, and which we absolutely love, and watched just, I don't know, hundreds of short films, which is also a medium we absolutely love. But I want to say part of that urgency came out of feeling like sometimes some films aren't taking the audience along for a ride.
Did you say they're boring? Are they boring?
Never.
They...
Not one film we've ever seen.
Perhaps I'd use the word indulgent. Yes. So it is something we were talking about. Just because we truly had to fight against Greener Grass being boring when we were writing. It was the conversation we had so often because the world is so heightened that it can be boring if you don't care about anything. Mm-hmm. And if... like the rules of the world don't make sense. So I think that was definitely part of the reason we paced it the way that we did. And then pacing is funny. This is something actually our editor Taylor said to us, is he had added up the running time of each scene and pointed out the ones that were longer. And he's like, you develop a language with your audience based on how long the scenes are, and they can feel it like a heartbeat when they're watching it. And when you have some that just stick out, the audience really feels that because you've established that pace with them, which I thought was a good lesson for us. And,
yeah. Does that affect how you write? I mean, if you guys were trying to write maybe shorter scenes, multiple locations, you know, to keep it moving, is that part of your process now?
Yeah, we very much, I think, write with the edit in mind and really think about the movie like an album. And, you know, if this scene is more slow, like a ballad, we want like a punk piece in here. Mm-hmm. Or I think we really think about the pacing and the order. And
that description exactly is something one of our directors at UCB, Michael Delaney, used to say about a sketch show, is to think of it like an album, and we would talk about it in that way.
I think, too, with our background in sketch, a number of the scenes kind of follow certain rules of sketch where an unusual thing happens early on in the scene, and then it heightens and plays out. And then once you've kind of... heightened that game or to the point where it's kind of been the most fun, then get out and do and go to another scene.
Yeah, I would say, it's not like John Waters was necessarily doing sketch in his early careers, but you can see that he's developed in the scene for all that the scene can do. You know, what can you get out of this one scene? Well, I guess that scene is done. Let's go. Like after the dog commits suicide, you're like, well, gotta go to what's next. You know, like it's a steam train of just like the locomotive just will not stop moving until Francine is dead or everyone else is. You know?
That's exactly right.
I would argue the Alcoholics Anonymous scene is so much like a sketch. You can also watch it on its own. The way that other alcoholics bully Francine into admitting she's an alcoholic.
I really don't know what to say. My name is Francine Fishpole.
And
And I am an alcoholic.
This, I mean, it's one of the things where you can, there's, his movies are so eminently quotable, I think, because he does kind of care about the minute details of things. You know, oh, can a scene last on its, can it stand on its own?
You know what's another sequence that's sketch-like? Is Bobo and Lulu hitting people with the broom. So they literally hit, like, one, two, and then the third is, like, the, you know, duck, duck, goose, so to speak. And that's the awesome choir lady that hijacks a bus and then bites a hole in Bobo's tire, beats the shit out of him.
The moment that woman bites the tire and it deflates is maybe my favorite moment in cinema.
I screamed. Yes. I truly think the first time I watched it, I texted you at like right after that happened. It's so crazy.
Yes. Yeah. Like so shocking.
Were there any moments in your film that called to mind of like what you guys were doing where you're like, oh yeah, I see this?
Maybe the best example of that is the scene, the photography scene where Lisa, Don's character, asks, they're taking a family photo, and Don's character asks the photographer if they can do another setup where she's sitting in a chair. And basically, she wants to recreate the photo Jill has in her house, sitting on a chair with her babies, with her family behind her. And the photographer, who's played by one of the greatest sketch actors of our time, John Millhiser, kind of looks around the room and realizes he doesn't have a chair and is like, oh, it's okay, I can figure this out. And then he starts calling his wife in to the room, and she comes out in a wheelchair. And it's our friend Santina Muha, also an incredible actress, who does live her life in a wheelchair. And basically, John and Santina's characters work out that they're going to give Santina's wheelchair to Lisa to sit in.
It's so awkward. It is so uncomfortable.
I've never explained that scene like that. Yeah, and that is we wrote that scene in one afternoon. We wrote it for Santina, and we knew in our guts that we were like, this is so fucking funny. Like it's just great. But like always, like that little voice in your head is like, will this be offensive in any way? Is this like, you want to make sure like everything is okay? And you know, we slept on it, and then I think we offered the part to Santina shortly after writing it, and she came back and she basically told us this is her favorite script that she's ever gotten, because it was a character that's in a wheelchair where the joke is not the wheelchair.
Yeah.
Her reaction to it meant a lot to us, but that was like, I would say screening that with audiences, you can feel the tension in the room.
Yeah, and I think it was really her excitement for it and her, like, passion for the part that gave us confidence, or a little more confidence, that we're like, this is good, like, or this is works.
Yeah.
Well, there's a kind of school of thought. People say that a John Waters movie couldn't get made today. It can't explore, like, the same themes. But then I see Greener Grass, and I'm like, well, I mean, can it? Like, you know, maybe it's just a different thought process, maybe something that has slightly more empathy towards it. And, you know, I see a scene like the wheelchair scene, and I'm like, wow, that's like so offensive, but not offensive. And it provokes these different thoughts of, what it means to be an other in a very different way than I think that we've been used to seeing with these shock movies.
It's true. I feel like John Waters has said that, like, you know, one of his favorite kinds of laughs is when people are so uncomfortable, they don't know whether or not they should be laughing. And Don and I, from our very early days in sketch comedy, that I feel like that was our sense of humor also. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it goes back to the conversation kind of like being bored and like respecting your audience. Is I think when I watch things, you can feel so numb so much of the time. And when you watch something that truly it makes you feel uncomfortable or shocked, that is my favorite viewing experience. And, you know, I think that's why John Waters just was so incredible to watch those early movies, because he does go far past anything we're used to seeing now.
Yeah. I heard him in an interview say, I don't care to watch feel-good movies. I feel good most of the time. Oh. I want to feel deeply uncomfortable.
I want to talk a little bit about social relevance, or what John Waters thinks about social relevance. He says, being socially redeeming is so very boring. I'm just trying to make people laugh. It's the only reason I pick up a movie camera. That, I mean, he says that, but at the same time, he also said in the same interview, this movie is pro-abortion.
Didn't John Waters once say, I wish I was a woman so I could have an abortion?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he's fucking with us, but, like, there are things that he believes in, whether or not at the time, like, in the 80s when he was, like, doing these interviews, like, that he would deign to say that he believed in them. But there's social relevance all over this fucking movie.
Oh, yeah. It's undeniably a satire. But doing satirical humor, it's... That is the best way John Waters could get to the audience that he wanted to get. I mean, I wonder if the people who would respond to the satire wouldn't go see the movie if they knew it was a satire. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. That it's humor is so great to get people in the chair and, like, soothe them with laughter and then be like, see, don't you get it?
Here's my treatise.
Yes.
Yes. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, I got to say, filming in locations, because I got to know how people in the neighborhood of Greener Grass really felt about what you guys were doing. And John Waters has some stories about that for Polyester, too. So we'll be right back.
The Greatest Generation is a Star Trek podcast that destigmatizes the very idea of having a Star Trek podcast.
We're Ben and Adam, the hosts of The Greatest Generation, and the technology we've developed is that nobody knows what you're playing in your earbuds.
You know, with legalization, it's easier than ever to find out what's in your buds. But we suggest that you legally find The Greatest Generation wherever you download your podcasts.
We'll send it to you in a discreet, unmarked package, and nobody has to know but us.
That's The Greatest Generation, the Star Trek podcast that you didn't know you needed, yet makes you feel like you belong.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Don Luby and Jocelyn DeBoer. I thought I'd switch up your names a little bit. And we're talking about polyester. I want to share a little anecdote that John Waters had from filming this. He said, quote, some of the neighbors where we rented the house weren't very pleased. Most of the neighbors were okay. They were in the film. One man got very uptight, however, started a lawsuit. I was hiding in the cellar. The sheriff was looking for me. He probably thought we had moved into the house to make movie after movie. We had cranes up there at 4 a.m. Divine was on the front lawn screaming, help, help! I don't blame him for being angry. I would have been probably very angry if it was me, except I would more likely enjoy the show business experiences. Let's just say he didn't seem excited by the whole show business experience. Eventually, we made friends and everything was okay, but talk about relationships with neighbors.
I can't believe they were allowed to film at 4 a.m.
I know, I'm jealous.
Yeah.
Baltimore.
It's not easy to film in a fancy suburb.
Yeah, at night especially.
Yeah.
It doesn't go. We changed a few scenes from night to day.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean that's kind of fun in a sense, because it does give the feeling in Greener Grass that everything is always sunshine.
Yes.
And that's terrifying.
Yes. Yes, that's right. We shot our movie in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia called Peachtree City. Mm-hmm. And we actually found it because our production company had another production shooting in Georgia, and they were trying to bundle us, basically, to do them both. And we were like, oh, we don't know about Georgia. We were looking in, like, Augusta and Savannah. We were like, these are so location-specific. This needs to look like anywhere in America. We don't think we can do Georgia, but, like, what is the town that your other film is shooting in? And they were like, it's called Peachtree City. And we're like, okay. And we Googled it, and it said, Peachtree City, the golf cart capital of the world. And we were like, oh,
we're in.
Yes. And then Don frantically called our producer.
Yeah, we called our producer and we're like, okay, can you tell us, is the other movie about people that drive golf carts around and you don't see cars? And she's like, no, it's about gun violence in schools. So you guys are good.
Thank God. We're sure. Yeah. So we truly feel like Peachtree City fell into our laps. The houses were matching pastel. It was a planned community started in the 50s with 100 miles of paved golf cart paths.
Oh my God.
Yes.
You couldn't have written a more perfect city for this movie.
We read the description on the website and saw pictures of golf carts driving through beautiful fall leaves, and we were obsessed.
Because it's people of all ages, too. It functions like a retirement community because of the golf carts, but parents drop their kids off to school in them. The parking lot at the grocery store, et cetera, is all golf carts.
I was wondering how you guys got all those fucking golf carts, but it turns out they just existed.
They just existed.
We have a scene in a parking lot filled with golf carts with hundreds of them, and that's just the high school parking lot.
During a school day. Is it 600 golf carts every day at the school? Yeah.
That's pretty intense, but very inspiring for a writer, I'd say.
It really was. But the people of Peachtree City were, very cooperative. Many of them are in the movie. And what we got a kick out of is several times people would kind of pull us aside, or you'd be like in the craft services line and be like, your movie gets it so spot on about Peachtree.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Like, the women of the community are like that.
Yes. But it's like, nobody thinks they're like that.
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, yes. They're like that.
Yes.
Yes. It's always the other people.
But we enjoyed that quite a bit.
I would love to talk a little bit about some how you get people interested in making a movie like this, because polyester for John Waters, it was one of the easier ones for him to get financed. It also was the most money that he had to deal with. He said, New Line Cinema put in a lot of money for the first time. Michael White, who did Rocky Horror Picture Show, helped, and I raised $50,000 from friends. I think making it in Baltimore made it more economical. We had incredible cooperation from the mayor's office. $320,000, and I think we spent a couple hundred thousand on 2 million Odorama cards.
I love that.
And he said that the Odorama cards are the thing that helped to get made. He said it was just a joke, but it worked. It was firstly a gimmick to get money people to finance the movie. I got a lot of people interested because of that idea. You can watch the movie without the card, but the audiences really enjoy using the card. And I got the idea from seeing kids that have all these scratch and sniff books. I thought it would be interesting to have bad smells, although the idea of Liquorama didn't work. He first wanted to do Liquorama.
I think it's not too late for a Liquorama.
I know.
I want John Waters to make that now.
Really?
Well, he took some cues from kind of like the old filmmakers and movie house people.
It's William Castle, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's William Castle. It's the same thing of just like, how do you get butts in the seats?
Yeah.
How do you have a gimmick that makes people want to see it? And, that kind of chance that he was taking. Did you guys ever feel like you had to do that kind of thing, like to sell your movie? Like, well, it's like this and like that and...
Oh, that's so funny. Well,
I think a little bit, because we had made a short film first, that much to our delight and a little surprise, like, did very well on the festival circuit and won an award at South By, and it struck people, and I think like that made it a little bit easier to have confidence that this people will respond to this kind of humor,
mm-hmm.
Because we had seen it with the short.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do try to turn to doing a short beforehand because you do have to sell it, especially if you're trying to do something different. Obviously, Polyester was really fucking different.
Yeah,
no one was making movies like this. Still very rare that people do something like so outlandish and so committed. But that was something where, you know, how do you get people to invest in you? Of course, he also had like many movies that he made before for like 10 grand a piece, you know?
Yeah.
Convincing people that someone wants to see a really like a few weird looking ladies, you know?
Right. Right. It's true.
Like telling people that Edith Massey is a star,
yeah.
you know? Like how do you,
right?
How do you convince like an executive at New Line to be like, no, it's Edith Massey and Mink Stole,
right? Exactly.
These two,
yes.
If I worked at New Line, I would be ecstatic if that pitch came in.
Yes, I know.
I don't work at New Line, unfortunately.
I know.
I guess we were in a very fortunate position where we had a single patron that was a fan of our shorts
mm-hmm.
that provided financing. So we were in a position where we luckily didn't have to convince a lot of investors to believe in us.
Yeah.
It's just, it is like very exciting to see the people who do respond to the movie. And I hope you hear people so often now talking about how, you know, cinema has gotten so bland and Marvel movies and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That I hope that financiers and people do take risks on people, you know, like young John Waters, because those we need that. Comedy needs that, and people need that.
Yeah, and it's been so kind of refreshing and nice going to some of like regional festivals and stuff with Greener Grass, because we'll find people in their 80s come up to us saying, this is the only movie I've ever seen twice at the Cleveland Film Festival, and I've been coming for 40 years. And people that I don't think we necessarily thought of as our target audience when we were writing it. And it's same with like 13-year-olds and women in their 60s and men like, in their 20s. Like, it's just, it's striking so many demographics in a way that has been really exciting. And
my aunt is like an Olympic level figure skating coach, and she came and saw it at Sundance, and then now she has like all these figure skating people being like, I need everyone to see it. And I'm like,
you
want to show that to like figure skating moms? And she's like, yes, that's the perfect demographic. So it's just that part is we're just shocked by and excited about.
Yeah. And this, I think it also maybe has a little bit something to do with what we were talking about before, which is like the kind of nervous laughter, because, you know, John Waters saying, I don't do things so that people will get upset and start crying, and that's not your movie either. And he said, quote, that's not the reaction I'm looking for. I do them, but try to make people laugh at them. Shock humor is making people laugh at things they would never laugh at if they were real. In a movie, they feel semi-safe laughing at it, but only semi-safe. They laugh and go, oh God, how can I be laughing at this? So mine is always a nervous laughter.
Yeah.
And that's something I can see a little bit in both of those, where it's just like, I don't know what these two women are going to do. There's also a murderer on the loose in your movie, and then you've got people trying to murder Francine in here. Like, these are
so true.
They're dastardly, terrible, terrible things. But you feel comforted enough to laugh at them.
Yeah, the foot stomper is so awful to watch, but why is that so funny?
Yes.
The Baltimore footstool. It's true.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much for coming and talking about Polyester and Greener Grass. And when will people be able to see Greener Grass?
Well, it's coming out in theaters and dropping online on October 18th.
Yeah.
So soon.
Okay. Yes. So thank you so much for coming in, and we wish you all the luck.
Oh, thank you. We're so happy to
be
here.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
And before we end the show, I just want to give a special thank you to Christine Zazula in Rhode Island, who was able to pull up a great book for me, John Waters Interviews by James Egan, or edited by James Egan. Thank you so much, Christine. Very helpful in my research today. And thank you all for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. And if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at switchbladesisters@maximumfun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/switchbladesisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
I want a divorce and a big fat settlement to go along with it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.